Hello, and welcome to episode number 107 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. As we speak, both within ufology and within the segments of the political and public spheres that are beginning to wrestle with this enigmatic topic, we are seeing ongoing debate about how much the intelligences behind what we colloquially refer to as the phenomenon should be framed as a threat, or at least a potential threat, or not. Some argue, better safe than sorry, in lobbying for an approach that assumes this is a threat until proven otherwise. As we delved into in the last episode of Point of Convergence, much of that particular argument leans on the notion that we have pretty much zero understanding as to the intent of these non-conventional others. But as I pointed out in that episode, the wealth of experience or testimony at our disposal would suggest otherwise. For within that extensive body of data, we see consistent messages provided by these non-human others to the human beings who have interacted with them. But even beyond this particular matter, which is already controversial because it ventures into questions around what kind of data should be considered legitimate and trustworthy or not, the lore we just referenced goes well beyond offering potential answers to the question of whether or not this amounts to a threat or not, even touching on ultimate matters such as the nature of reality and even an alternate history regarding human origins. What is perhaps most challenging of all to our secular and still largely physicalist, that is to say, reductionistic materialist Western civilization, is notions that arise in experiencer data that speak to what might best be called spirituality. This challenges, of course, our typical conceptions because most see this entire matter as involving technology and a potential clash of space-faring civilizations, not one delving into ultimate meaning and the evolution of souls. And yet that is indeed where this body of data goes, which perhaps only adds fuel to the fire in terms of why this lore is not taken as legitimate by the powers that be. If experiencer lore stretches our expectations regarding what the UFO phenomenon is even ultimately about, in what precise ways does it do so? And how do these elements in particular make our contemporary meaning-making machine uncomfortable? And how might the ignoring of these elements, simply because they are unexpected and inconvenient, potentially create a scenario where we miss the forest for the proverbial trees? These are precisely the issues we'll seek to gain clarity around in this, the 107th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to point out that if you would like to support this podcast, and in so doing gain access to all of my content, which includes Point of Convergence, Liminal Frames, Event Horizon, OTC Squared, and various feature series I create, as well as early access and discounts to online courses and in-person retreats, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's get to today's topic. We're going to be talking about the way that spirituality, for lack of a better word, is central to this particular topic, the topic of the UFO phenomenon. Now, on the one hand, perhaps this is surprising to people, because isn't this about potentially space aliens coming from Alpha Centauri or Zeta Reticuli or something like that? And wouldn't that be more about different civilizations on the physical plane learning to interact with each other? What does spirituality have to do with that? Of course, when we think about people like Diana Pasulka and even historic researchers like Jacques Vallée, they've pointed out the clear overlap with religious lore and religious history. In fact, we've covered many times on this podcast, as well as on Liminal Frames, how many of our ancient stories that are recorded in scripture may actually, and perhaps most likely, are referencing perhaps some of these very same beings. And of course, when technology is sufficiently far ahead, as Arthur C. Clarke famously pointed out, it will be perceived as magic, and those beings will be perceived as gods, even if it's God with a small g, rather than this monotheistic God notion that came later. So this is something to be aware of, that the overlap has always been there. And once you get past the surface veneer of some of the language differences, which of course we should expect will change over time, there is remarkable overlap between religious history and the modern UFO phenomenon. But that is not to say or to discount that this is technological in nature. It is, and this is exactly why this is so challenging to us. We assume it must be one or the other, that if they are actually spiritual beings, then they're going to be acting basically only with consciousness kind of capacities and not with technology. To us, this seems like a separate category altogether. And that leads many, many people to ignore what is clearly in the picture here. We get certain groups that either only look at the technology piece, while other groups only look at the spiritual piece. Very few look at both and try to make sense of that and try to reconcile what this might mean about the nature of reality itself. And again, as I've been saying many times on this podcast, that is the question that this phenomenon entertains specifically. What is the nature of the phenomenon? Who are we ultimately, along with who are they? The way this particular topic tends to obliterate our pre-existing categories was addressed on numerous occasions by Dr. John Mack, such as when he said, quote, "But I believe there is a core belief in our culture that is violated by the alien abduction phenomenon, namely the total separation of the spirit and the physical world. We have made that gulf inviolate, relegating to religion the spirit, subjective, world, and assigning to science the material, objective, domain. We simply do not know what to do with a phenomenon that crosses that seemingly inviolable barrier. It shocks the foundations of our belief structure. Our minds have no place to put such a thing," unquote. This is absolutely true, and John, of course, was ahead of his time in recognizing this, and I still see this way that the phenomenon confounds modern thinking even today, even though we've come a long way in terms of having a conversation in the public sphere about these matters. We still tend to see people only paying attention to certain aspects of the data and ignoring others. We tend to get either those who see this as only a spiritual matter or others who only see this as a matter of technology, advanced civilizations interacting with us, etc. And this is part of the problem. We really need to bring in all of the data so that we can make sense of the phenomenon as it presents itself, not as we wish it would be. And this brings to mind something I recently posted to social media when I said, quote, "It's very clear to me that we're still seeing distinct conversations within ufology, where each subset assumes it's engaging with the quote-unquote real data. Bias reigns supreme and is even more consequential when it functions as an unseen filter," unquote. In other words, what I see happening is that different groups of people are taking certain aspects of the data and only paying attention to that and trying to paint a picture of the total phenomenon based only on that subset of the data. Furthermore, they are convinced that they are actually looking at all of the relevant data because they are bringing certain pre-existing presumptions to their research, presumptions that they assume are well supported and that everyone who's a clear-thinking individual would agree with. But of course, that's just not the case, and that's why we have other groups that have a different subset of the data, and they're convinced that they are only looking at it from a clear point of view and only based on assumptions that we clearly understand are supported. So these two groups, even though they're looking at different aspects of the data and are bringing different assumptions to the table, kind of deny the fact that they're doing that and are largely oblivious to the fact that they're doing that. This is the challenge. And again, when I think about the journey that John Mack went on and the journey that I've been on and friends of mine and colleagues of mine, you get to that point where you realize our old categories are just not sufficient to make sense of this data. And eventually you have to start destroying those boxes and trying to start from scratch almost, asking yourself, what would the nature of reality be such that it would produce this kind of data? And all of the data, not just a cherry-picked segment of the data. Furthermore, not only does this phenomenon overlap with religious history, but even there, we often get people who assume, therefore, that those were just misunderstandings in the past, that because these were pre-scientific people in the ancient world, they didn't understand that these were basically modern, non-human intelligences working with technology, working under the assumptions of physicalism. Again, they wouldn't even admit that these are assumptions. They just assume that they are axioms we can trust. But they assume that's the case. But what this literature points to, I hear I'm talking about the experiencer lore, the testimony, the vast testimony that has been gathered over time from experiencers, specifically to do with the abduction and hybridization campaign that I've focused on over the last couple episodes. In that lore, it's very clear that the messages themselves are spiritual. It's not just that these aliens are being misunderstood as spiritual figures like they were in the past, but that actually the content of the messages themselves are spiritual. Now, of course, this is a term that's a bit tricky and a bit slippery, but what we're really getting at is essential matters, ultimate matters. This is speaking to the ultimate nature of what it means to be a sentient being in the cosmos. And it's a sense that transcends just one incarnation where we identify with just one body-mind, as we say in Buddhism. In other words, the brain we have, the body we have, and that experience we assume in modern culture is the fullness of what we are. But what these beings repeatedly point to is that that's not the case, that spirit or soul, if you will, transcends the body. And in fact, they work with bodies in ways that really make this clear. And this actually makes some people coming from religious backgrounds kind of uncomfortable. So that's what's interesting about this data is it, again, obliterates these pre-existing categories. Religious people are not so comfortable with the way that they can move souls around within different bodies. And likewise, people coming from a physicalist perspective, that is a reductionistic materialist perspective, are not at all comfortable that we're even talking about souls, that we're even talking about the essence of a human being or any kind of sentient being for that matter, that transcends incarnation in a body. So this is, again, why this particular topic is so fascinating, because it confounds each of these pre-existing categories and ways of seeing the world, at least for our modern Western civilization. Again, other kinds of cultures, cultures with shamanic backgrounds and the like, already see things this way. This kind of data is actually not confounding so much to them. This is already the way that they've been operating with these assumptions in mind. It's particularly the Western perspective that has trouble with this. And what's interesting is that what I found over time is that these things are all tied together. There's kind of a synchronistic orchestration, not just to our own lives, but to the history of our entire species. And what's interesting, and I pointed to this on different podcast episodes, is that even within Western civilization, the data itself is driving us back towards something like idealism or even dual aspect monism, a different conception of reality that is clearly not physicalist. And this is happening at the very same time that we are beginning to entertain these conversations about who are these other beings and what are they telling us? And what we're finding is that they're telling us things that are in sync with this move back towards a notion like idealism in terms of the ultimate nature of reality. And of course, as I've said many times, even the revelations of quantum mechanics are pointing in this very same direction. So this is all converging at this point. This is the point of convergence, and we are experiencing it in our lifetimes as we speak, which leads me to say, as I often do, what a time to be alive. I really want to drive home a point that I referenced in the introduction there. This has to do with the way that experiencer testimony is ignored, either because it's assumed that we can't rely on this kind of information, even though we do rely on this kind of information in courts of law, for instance, when we're actually trying to decide if someone is guilty or not. But perhaps even more precariously, people ignore this data because they don't like the nature of it. They don't like what's being communicated through the experiencer lore. And so that gives them an extra reason to dismiss it. Now, again, this is a quick bait and switch that we do with ourselves, even sometimes without being fully aware. In other words, they might not admit that they're ignoring it because they just don't like what's being communicated to experiencers from these beings. But that's definitely in play here. That's partly what's going on. And again, as I've said before, because we don't have peer review and a really kind of close inspection of methods and whatnot, this kind of flies under the radar because there has not been a close scientific examination of this phenomenon across the board. And so this lack of quality and bias shows up over and over and over again. But here's something I would say about the abduction literature, specifically the testimony of those that have been abducted or contacted by these mysterious others. I would argue that it's veridical, that is truthful, because it is complex and because it is not one-dimensional. In other words, if you're going to make something up, I don't think you'd make up something like this, because this really does, again, challenge our notions, challenges our categories even. Who would do that? And why would this happen time and time and time again, cross-culturally, from people that are coming from different walks of life who didn't know each other, who clearly had no interest in this phenomenon prior to it contacting them? This is, again, something that John Mack ran into over and over again, and he was convinced these people were being truthful, even though the nature of the messages were confounding. The nature of the experience was confounding. Again, it often seems to happen in an alternate realm or an alternate state of consciousness. And again, even here, we're not even sure what we mean by that, because we have assumptions about what real reality is, quote unquote, and yet what they are doing and how they're interacting with us seems to even transcend that. And we don't have a good way to describe that, so we just call it an alternate realm or an alternate dimension. This, for instance, gets to this. This is a quote from someone named Catherine, who was involved in John Mack's research. This is from his book, Abduction: Human Encounters with Aliens. Quote, "It's like I have access to an entirely different part of me that I don't have access to in normal waking consciousness. In this altered state, Catherine feels she knows more of them. I know more about them. It's not like kind of half-knowing. Maybe something happened like when I'm awake. The knowing, she said, is just as real as in our ordinary consciousness. It's the same thing as knowing something here, but it's just that the door was shut in my mind and I don't have the key to it, and they do," unquote. So again, here she's speaking to the fact that they are definitely in control. And again, as I pointed to in the last episode, some people might cry, that's a lack of agency, that's a human rights violation, because they are in control, we are not, and we didn't say we wanted this. Again, I understand that from a physicalist plane, assuming this is all we are. But the nature of the data seems to suggest this is not all we are. And again, when we think about all of the non-dual traditions that have been part of human history, they say much of the same thing. And again, even the most recent quantum revelations are pointing in the same direction. So we clearly seem to be understanding here that reality is more complex than we realize. We might slot these experiences into alternate state of consciousness, but that's really just a placeholder again. We don't really know how this is happening. Clearly, they understand something about reality that we still struggle to understand, even on a conceptual level. This is again demonstrated in the experience of Karen, who's actually a friend of mine that worked with John back in the day. And here I'm going to quote from John's second book around these matters, titled Passport to the Cosmos: Human Transformation and Alien Encounters. Quote, "Changes in the perception of time and space in association with the abduction phenomenon are sometimes accompanied by a sense of the existence of, or of moving into, other realities or dimensions. This may be difficult for experiencers to articulate clearly. Here is Karen struggling to express her ontological confusion, the altered perception of space and time during her encounters, and their so-called interdimensional quality. Karen calls the other reality she perceives during her experiences the fourth dimension. It's what we call illusion, but it's not illusion. It's not illusion. It exists. It's there. That's where they live. You don't use language when you're in this other experience. You use color, and you have vibration and everything else. Space-time in this dimension, she says, is quote-unquote irrelevant," unquote. Now, again, that's very fascinating in light of what we've learned since that time. So, again, that was back in the 1990s when John was wrestling with these matters and interviewing these different contactees and abductees. But as I pointed out on podcast episodes in the past, we have physicists, cutting-edge physicists, world-renowned physicists like Nima Arcani-Hamed, telling us that even the data, even the math that has been conducted in exploring the nature of reality in physics, tells us that space-time is not foundational. In other words, space-time is not ultimately real. It's more like the shadow cast on the wall of a deeper structure that we're just beginning to conceive of. And this is interesting because here Karin is saying back in the 1990s, quote, space-time in this dimension, she says, is irrelevant, unquote. So again, we see this convergence happening where in our time, we're seeing empirical data coming out of science that's supporting the notions that some of these abductees spoke to back in the 80s and 90s when they were ridiculed for this. I have another friend who was involved in that time period who's an abductee. And when he tried to explain to a news reporter one time that this seemed to be happening in alternate dimensions, he was basically mocked to his face on air. And she said, there are only three dimensions. We know this already. You're just making things up, basically, was the assumption. These are the kinds of characterizations that abductees and contactees had to deal with time and time again because this information was ahead of our time, and their familiarity with these different aspects of existence were certainly ahead of our time, so much so that we didn't even have ways of considering these things. We didn't even have the boxes to put these aspects of experience into, although that's beginning to change now. And actually, to highlight that point, I'd like to read a passage from the third volume of the God's Man of War trilogy by Peter Lavenda and Tom DeLonge, where they address the way that we need to consider this matter and how it, again, tends to extend beyond the categories and to some degree transcend, you might even argue obliterate, the categories we've thus far used to try to make sense of it. I quote, "We feel that the UFO phenomenon represents a challenge to the Cartesian habit of diversification of knowledge into separate realms of matter, mind, and God. What we propose is a return to a kind of Renaissance understanding, not only of the UFO phenomenon specifically, but of the world in general, in which these realms are interdependent and permeable. In other words, we are asking to revisit our notion of reality completely. By doing so, we may find that the rather partisan perspectives of the UFO communities that focus on only one or two possible explanations for the phenomenon, most notably the extraterrestrial hypothesis, or ETH, do not adequately describe the true nature of the experience, which may be more holistic in terms of physics, biology, and consciousness than we suspect." Unquote. Here, I say in response to that particular passage, yes, indeed, and it's not just that different kinds of consciousness states are employed here to make a message. It's that those experiences themselves are part of the message, that by exposing us to a broader frame of reference, it changes how we understand the nature of reality and ultimately even our place within that reality. And this is all by design, I would argue, in terms of what these beings are doing. So even when it comes to fear states we go through, which of course is part of the picture, I've mentioned many times that ontological shock is pretty much a guarantee in these experiences. But that fear can be used as a tool to take you somewhere deeper. And I would argue that they see our fear states as often part of the problem. So while they will sometimes try to go around them, they often will drive us through those fears so as to go beyond them, so as to transcend them. And again, the kind of states of consciousness and alternate realm experiences they expose us to are there to actually teach us something about reality. And often these elements include symbology, a really rich symbology. Now, again, according to our modern physicalist kind of notions, these things are kind of ignored or at least put into a subcategory that is not considered as real or as important as what we experience in our waking state reality. But again, in terms of this convergence of timelines, we have someone like Bernardo Kastrup leaning on the understanding that Jung and Pauli came to, suggesting that synchronicity is actually the nature of reality, that when you average everyone's experience, you might end up with something that looks more like causality, but when you actually look at individual experience, synchronicity is everywhere. That reality itself, therefore, is meaningfully driven. And again, if that's not a message about spirituality, quote unquote, I don't know what is. So in other words, what Bernardo would point to is that symbology is just not relegated to the dream world, but that we even see what appears to be symbols in our waking state experience as well, because the nature of reality is ultimately mental, something like idealism, or for some others might prefer dualistic monism. But the bottom line is that basically this symbolic way of teaching about the nature of reality is both experienced in our dream world and in our waking state world. And we think of the famous case where Jung's patient was discussing a particular kind of beetle that was encountered in her dream. And then that very same beetle, a scarab beetle, came into Jung's office, flew into his office at the very same time. And this uncanny synchronicity was finally what it took to crack open this woman's psyche so that she could see something beyond what she had seen before. And again, this speaks to the phenomenon because this is what they do with us as well, including taking us through fear states, right through them, driving us through them, not around them, because as the expression goes, sometimes the only way past is through. They do that with us so that we end up on the other side of that to partly understand our own power. So this is interesting. And again, we see this evidence not just in the phenomenon, but in other elements of reality and teaching and revelation as well. So now that we've put aside that physicalist assumption again, that symbology doesn't really count, or it's only something that appears in the dream world, which isn't ultimately quote unquote real, since we've established that that doesn't hold water, let's turn again to the symbolically rich nature of the experiences that abductees and contactees experience when in the presence of these non-human others. Quote, "This is not received merely cognitively, like a lecture. Abductees experience powerful images of vast destruction, with the collapse of governmental and economic infrastructures and the total pollution and desertification of the planet. This knowledge is felt profoundly in their bodies. And I have been greatly moved as they sob on the couch and experience heartache so intense that they can barely bring themselves to speak of it. It is the kind of knowledge that must be translated into action." Writer and futurist Jean Houston, at the Congress of the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in September 1993, commented that all myths begin with a form of betrayal. Perhaps the human betrayal of the Earth itself is giving rise to a new myth of interspecies relationship and creation, unquote. And again, that's from John Mack's Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. And of course, that passage we just read is very indicative of the body of literature in general, in terms of the messages that are provided, the visions that are experienced regarding a future desertification of our planet, of the Earth. And this relates to what I talked about in the last podcast episode, when I pointed out the concern for the Earth and actions taken on behalf of the Earth are paramount. Again, part of our anthropocentric bias is that we assume we should be on center stage. We assume that we are the main deal here. But what these beings make very clear is that they do have major concerns for the Earth, and they will take actions to deal with us if we put the Earth in jeopardy, as well as the other species, the entire biosphere, etc. If we were in their shoes, I think we would understand. Again, it's only anthropocentric bias and a kind of privileged and entitled position we've had up until now in our ignorance that has presented a situation where we fail to think in these kinds of ways. So as we've been discussing on this episode, as well as the previous episode, the ways that these beings interact with us and the actions they seem to be taking challenge our very understanding of how things work and certainly collapse the categories that we think with. This also happens with the tweaking of the human genome. We, of course, think about this in terms of physicality. We think about engineering the human genome so as to create perfect babies and things like that, and parents might eventually pick from a menu certain properties they want, certain features they want, certain characteristics they want in their children, both physiologically, biologically, as well as in terms of their demeanor and things like that. But what these grays, these particular beings, not just the grays, also the mantis types and whatnot are involved, what they seem to be involved in here is growing spiritual capacity through their engineering of the human genome. So, of course, you have to plan for the entire rolling out of a species. So there are different epochs that you have to work with and make sure that they thrive in those different earlier times before you can get to a later version of a human being or any kind of being where it has increased spiritual capacity. But that's basically what's been the case with the more recent Homo sapiens sapien. And again, they would say to us, and they say to experiencers, that they continue to work with the human genome so as to increase spiritual capacity and spiritual potential. So again, we have this pairing of physiology, biology, science, technology, with spirituality, essence, and those kinds of things. Now, this is also evidenced in terms of the experience that abductees and contactees have in the presence of these beings, that it's almost like the architecting they're doing at this level, on this realm, actually is pale in comparison to the experience that people have with these others in whatever space, quote-unquote, again, that's just a placeholder, they tend to inhabit. And this is evidenced in people's conversation around feeling like they're returning home or returning to source when they're with these beings. Many, many abductees do not want to return when they are in the presence of these beings, not just because there's this telepathic kind of communication that feels very free-flowing and heartfelt, but also because that reality feels more real and more natural, actually. For those people who haven't had these kinds of experiences, that's very hard to imagine because all they've ever known, as far as they know anyway, in their waking state consciousness, is this reality. So it's hard for them to picture a reality that's more real than real, that is to say, more real than this one. And yet that's what's communicated time and time again. And that the nature of that, again, using as a placeholder, space or realm, is actually more spiritually infilled. It seems to be more like the kinds of realms described in near-death experiences. And of course, again, that's an overlap with the data where people in near-death experiences encounter this remarkable realm. They feel like they've returned home and they really don't want to leave. They often have to be convinced for one reason or another to go back because it's really not their preference. This also happens in the abduction and hybridization campaign. Once people are past the ontological shock and once they've established more of a relational dynamic with these beings, again, beings, like I said in the last episode, that they now recognize as being part of their experience before this lifetime itself. So before they even knew their parents, they knew these beings. And this, again, has profound implications for how we understand what this phenomenon is ultimately about. This is also evidenced when we have different abductees and contactees who, in the presence of talking about these experiences, have also come into awareness of when they did come into the body for a particular incarnation. And again, this is part of the entire enterprise. It is not separate. It's not distinct. So it's not physical versus spiritual. It's a kind of reality experience that encompasses both. So again, I'm going to read from John Mack's Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. And this was when someone was actually recalling the incarnation experience. Quote, asked how he went into her womb. I just went right into her one winter, he said. Everybody was asleep and there was a little bit of a fire left in the fireplace. I went into her womb. I knew that's where I wanted to go. When I went in, she became pregnant. She was laying there sleeping and I went into her, unquote. So once again, these are wrapped up together. These memories, these experiences are tied in with encounters that we call abductions or contact experiences, again, which helps us transcend our notion of what this is even ultimately about. Because as you remember from the last episode, this is actually a dual kind of enterprise, that we have a soul journey that we make decisions about in terms of these different incarnations and how they will serve our soul journey. And these other beings, grays, mantis types, and whatnot, work with us to accomplish that. So they have certain goals they are accomplishing on a species-wide level, and then we have certain goals we're accomplishing, although again, with a place of agency at a higher rung on the spiral from that higher self, making decisions that will benefit the evolution of our souls. These are not two things. These are part of the very same enterprise. Again, it probably will be quite a while before our public conversation is ready to move to that level of discourse, but that's where we need to go. And again, at least in the book we read from earlier, the third volume of God's Man of War, there are others that are beginning to recognize that as well. When it comes to the ways that this phenomenon tends to stretch our conceptions and sometimes confound our expectations, we think also of the way that these beings are sometimes dressed. Now, often we do see them either not having clothing at all and often not displaying any kind of genitalia. We do also see times where they are wearing these tight-fitting jumpsuits that we might expect as part of sci-fi lore, especially when more humanoid and human-like beings are encountered. But sometimes with any kind of being in this domain, we also see what looks like religious garb being donned by these different beings. And this, again, really confuses people. It seems like a conflation of completely different types of data. I remember one time on social media coming across someone's recounting of an experience they had, and they had created an illustration to demonstrate this experience. And what we saw was a mantis being, a giant 7-8-foot-tall mantis being, dressed with this purple cape that looked very regal, almost like royalty or some sort of priestly class. We don't think about these beings in those terms. Again, when we think about the overlap with religious history, we assume the religious affiliation or the way that these beings were ascribed to as gods had to do with the human beings, the poor human beings who didn't know any better, who basically chose to worship these other creatures. But what we see here is that these beings have a self-understanding that involves spirituality, and that in addition to that, we sometimes even see parts of the craft, parts of the ship, parts of these technological vehicles that have an aspect of the craft that is dedicated to kind of worship services, where people go and in adoration give thanks for source consciousness, or what we might call God. Again, there's different ways you can refer to this. Some terms have more baggage than others. Again, some terms have more baggage in one culture. Other terms have more baggage in another culture, even within our species. But bottom line, this notion that there is a creative aspect to the cosmos and that we give thanks to this and we can be in relationship with this source cause that is ongoing is something that is demonstrated in these beings. Again, we think about the raw contact material and other kinds of channel material that speak to what these beings say to us. They say that we are all an expression of that same source consciousness. We are all part of this oneness. And again, this oneness notion is not just in our ancient religious histories and non-dual circles and whatnot. And it's not just what these various beings are telling us and sometimes indicating in their behavior and their kind of dress even, when we encounter them. But we also see this in the revelations coming out of quantum mechanics. Again, this oneness understanding is emerging. And as it emerges, we come back full circle to an understanding that has existed within humankind's most ancient traditions for thousands and thousands of years. Now, if you're looking for a book, perhaps, that describes the experience of a person that really runs into this spiritual element and has their perspective changed by the spiritual element, I would highly recommend Jeff Selver's book, which is titled The Rising, and the subtitle is And the Alien Plan to Build an Enlightened City on Earth. So the book is The Rising. The author is Jeff Selver. He's from Western Canada, and he describes a remarkable lifetime of experience with beings that, again, are what we would typically describe as the quintessential gray aliens. But his experience of them was very much spiritual, even though technology and the taking of semen as part of a reproductive kind of experiment or ongoing enterprise was very much part of the enterprise as well. So this is a perfect example of a testimony that tends to collapse our pre-existing paradigm. It involves different elements that we don't tend to put together and yet seem commonplace in these experiences he has with these grays. I now want to read from a section of the book where he encounters not just the usual figures he encounters that he has kind of a relational dynamic with that stretches over decades, but he's also introduced to this one particular figure who he understands is kind of an ancient spiritual elder. And this is a remarkably profound experience for him. And I want to turn to this now just so we can understand how much this really is part and parcel of the entire enterprise, even though it's sometimes not first understood that way. Quoting from the book, quote, "We appeared to be in an underground base, as the walls were rocks, and I got the impression we were underwater as I could see drips on the walls, hear a dissipating stream landing on concrete, and smell the salinity. Also, it was humid here, giving the impression we were in an equatorial climate. I walked down the plank to a cave entrance, and in front was the elder. This is a female-like figure, gray, that he was most used to encountering. He had a very warm and relational dynamic with her. She was standing with a 7-foot-tall gray alien with a bulbous head, wearing a floor-length white robe so I couldn't see its feet. The robe had a large stand-up collar. As I approached, the elder told me I needed to bow my head out of respect for this being, which I did. She said, "This is our Ancient One." A telepathic signature implying a singular, long-living individual with great wisdom, whom I could feel the elder was reverent towards. It was a female and looked like one of them, yet older, ancient, and weathered. The Ancient One was immediately interested in me, reaching out to take my hand and feeling it with both of her hands. She was wearing a ring that had a small blue hologram protruding from it. After staring deep into my eyes to read or check something out, she then said, "Your path will align right." I was bewildered by what was occurring, wondering why I was meeting this individual. We began walking at a slow pace into the cave, which itself was a large hallway with a curved ceiling. Usually when I walked with the beings, they led the way. But for unknown reasons, today they let me walk alongside them. The way the Ancient One's gown dragged on the ground gave me the impression she was floating, and that she may have been shorter than I could see initially. We came to an open door on the right side of the cave. The Ancient One moved forward next to it, turned towards me, and opened her arm for me to walk in. I entered, stopped just past the door, and observed a large, bright white with 10 to 15 glass cribs, each with a baby in them. Several tall female grays with slightly elongated cone-shaped heads were holding or tending to the babies, projecting motherly feelings to them. One crib stood out from the rest, placed center to the others and the room, with cables going into it from a metal device which hung from the ceiling. I looked back at the Ancient One and she said, "You were one of these." This whole setup was a strange sight, and I didn't know what to make of it. I walked in and began looking at some of these babies and saw that they had pure black eyes, and some were spaced further apart than a human's, and with slightly bigger craniums. I assumed these babies were a mix of human and gray alien genetics. The elder and the Ancient One simply stood and watched me. Yet when I peered into the crib that stood out, with the cables going into it, I saw an even stranger sight. Inside was a species I didn't recognize. It resembled a rat, on its back with a tiny white gown covering its body, and over its head and covering its eyes was a helmet with cables attached, with a snout exposed. It was crying, though I didn't know if it was making physical noises or was telepathically distressed, like a normal baby when it was uncomfortable. I asked, "What are you going to do with these babies?" She said, "We're going to treat them," implying that this was a nursery. I walked up to her at the doorway and asked, "Why did you show this to me?" "Because you'll one day know and be part of this." I didn't understand what they meant and was perplexed by the experience, but they thought it was important. We left that room and began walking back the way we came. In the large hallway, the elder said to me, "Fulfill your curiosity," pointing at the Ancient One, which I interpreted as, "Ask the Ancient One anything you want to know." I was being encouraged to interact with her more, so I asked the ultimate question that up to this point was never clearly answered. "Where are you from?" "We are from your Zeta Reticuli star system." "What are you?" She said, "We come from a long lineage of genetic races. We are a genetic amalgamation. We've mixed, combined, and contorted to create the beings you look at today. But we are a long lineage of genetic histories, longer than your human race has been thinking for itself." I really didn't understand what or who she was, so I asked, "Can you tell me more about you?" She said, "I am beyond your comprehension. I am an elder of their ancients. I ground my kind in their mystical knowledge. I root them in a spiritual dimension, religion, as you would call it." I felt I was being told that the Greys think of their dimensional experience as a religious experience, though religion as we humans understand it might be the wrong word here. Typically, the negative connotation associated with the word religion is mindlessly believing with no evidence or proof. From everything I experience with the beings, belief does not appear to be involved, as they have access to so much more dimensionality than we can conceive, the white room being an example. Therefore, they don't simply believe, they know. Yet what is a part of the human religious experience that might be comparable to what I understand is the Gray's idea of religion in worship, reverence, and sacredness. Again, in the white room, as I entered, they knew it would be a spiritual event, as evidenced by the butterfly archway, which symbolized transformation, the sacredness of transforming a mind to embrace its higher spirit. She continued, I help them see the true spiritual nature of the universe, and this is what I connect them to. I am their glue. They travel the stars, but they only see with their eyes. With me, they see all beings. I said, I've never met anyone like you. She replied, not yet, implying something was around the corner in my life. Having their genetics, I was always under the impression they were trying to make me like one of them. So I asked, how can I become like you? She replied, you can't become like us, but you can become like you. You can become the perfect star that you've been trying to become, but your help is on the way. Guidance is coming. I wanted to ask about my future because they kept referring to it, but figured they wouldn't divulge any of that information. So I then asked something I never understood fully. Why did you need my semen? Because your protoplasm contains ingredients for the stars, sending me an image of a star system. I understood this to mean that semen contains protoplasm, the living part of the cell that they use to seed other solar systems. But why do you do that? Because the universe is hungry to be born, she said matter-of-factly. I understood this to mean that the aware living universe, i.e. God, in another word, desires to manifest its spirits into bodies. This is reminiscent of what I was reading in the spiritual books at that time of my life, that all of the souls in the universe are God, and that it grows and evolves itself by incarnating souls into the physical realm. This wasn't some New Age philosophy. This was the way it was for the Grays and for the nature of the universe, and they appeared to offer their services to this desire by creating bodies for souls to live in. She continued, so we are grateful that you offered your semen for life to be placed in other star systems. Unquote. So here again we see in just this one passage from this one book depicting one event in this person's lifelong encounters with these beings, that these categories we think of as being distinct are anything but when it comes to the experience and the operations of these Grays, these prototypical Grays. Now again, here we see the blending of technology and spirituality working towards something I described before as soul science. And what we have further elucidated here in this one passage is the understanding that this is a spiritual endeavor, religious you might even say, in nature, in the sense that this is their way of participating in a cosmic enterprise where Source itself is instantiated through these different kinds of forms across the wide expanse of space-time, which again is just a construct within the one mind, if you will, in order to facilitate novel experience from which the entire cosmic order grows and even evolves. And this is central to the entire enterprise. And the bottom line is that we really cannot consider the fullness of the UFO phenomenon, as we colloquially refer to it, without understanding all of these elements and what they are ultimately in service to. Which again, I just want to point out that it's not to say that every encounter with every kind of non-human intelligence is involved in this particular enterprise, because we have stages of consciousness, a spectrum of consciousness development. Those that are closest to Source, therefore the most evolved, tend to be involved in these kinds of enterprises. But those still working on a service-to-self kind of mentality are going to still be dominating and trying to take advantage of and operating under notions of scarcity and the illusion of separation. So overarchingly, what's involved here is a cosmic dance and a spectrum of consciousness development, which is inherent to our being as well as to their being, beings that ultimately are not separate, but rather just expressions of this one underlying unitive experience. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.